From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is senior VOA Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Stephen Grand, Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. The Middle East Strategy Task Force aims to better understand the underlying dynamics behind the current crises in the region. It seeks to develop a new approach to the Middle East to support a stable, prosperous order based on legitimate, well-governed states that embrace the talent and potential of their people. Stephen Grand is one of the authors of a recent comprehensive report which outlines a multi-pronged approach to achieving peace and security in the Middle East. The report's co-chairs are former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. The single biggest takeaway from the report is that the Middle East is not condemned to the current cycle of conflict, that there is nothing inevitable or unfixable about what ails the states of the region today, whether in Syria, Iraq, Libya, or Yemen. It asserts that there is actually a large and growing number of people in the Middle East who can not only imagine a better future, but are already actively working toward it, even in the most difficult circumstances. In addition to being the executive director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force, Stephen Grand is a non-resident senior fellow at the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution, where he served as the director from 2006 to 2013. He also serves as chairman of the board of the Project on Middle East Democracy. And Stephen Grand joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss the findings of his recent report. Stephen Grand, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Carol.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Thank you, Carol.
He's our in-house Middle East expert. Well, Stephen Grand, first of all, congratulations on this report. What prompted you to undertake this study, which is rather optimistic, I must say, given the circumstances, and what does a new strategic approach to the region look like?
Sure. Well, this was a two-year undertaking, and the idea really at the outset was to take a comprehensive look at the many, many challenges confronting the Middle East and ask the question, how might stakeholders in and outside the region working together somehow be able over the long term to change the trajectory of the region away from violence and instability towards more prosperous, better governed states and a better governed region? To do that, we spent almost 2 years asking a lot of questions, mostly of people from the region. We spent time in the region. We spent time speaking with the regional ambassadors here on a regular basis. We had a very distinguished senior advisory panel that helped us periodically in our thinking. And we also had 5 functional working groups comprised of experts from here, from Europe, but also comprised of people from the region or based in the region that looked at various issues such as governance, economics, refugees, religion, and the like in the region, and prepared reports that we borrowed from in completing our final report. The effort really was motivated by the view that the United States really can no longer dictate, nor can any other outside power really dictate events in the Middle East, that it's really time for people in the region to step up and define their own future. But they need the help of the United States and other actors to get there, particularly when it comes to ending the civil wars and putting the region on a more secure trajectory going forward.
Quickly, a follow-up. You state in the report, which is extraordinary, that disengagement in the Middle East is not really practical for the West, particularly the United States. But how do you reconcile that with the current Trump administration, who is, in a sense, sort of doing just that, disengaging? We have a theme of America First. Mr. Trump would like to disengage with many regions, in addition to other international agreements, the Paris Climate Accord, etc. And we are witnessing proposals to cut budgets, particularly for the State Department. And I assume that diplomacy, this type of engagement supporting civil society, these very people in the region who you say need to step up, then they're not going to get the support. So how does that play out?
Sure. We very early on decided what we were looking at was not a crisis in the region, but really a global crisis emanating from the region. You have four civil wars underway in this region with tremendous destabilizing effects, not only for the Middle East, but for the rest of the world, whether it's in terms of sectarianism, extremism, terrorist violence, where we're seeing attacks both in the United States and even more in Europe, and in terms of the human costs and migration flows that are emanating from the Middle East. So our argument was that you can't simply wall yourself off from this region. I think the administration is going to learn that along the way. It's still finding its feet. It doesn't have the proper staffing in place. There are disparate voices trying to do different things. But I hope and think they will come to the conclusion eventually that this is a region that can't be left to its own devices, that the power vacuums that exist because of the civil wars need to be filled, and they can't be filled by the nihilistic forces of groups like ISIS.
Now a question from Mohammed.
Steve, the report stated that wars in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen are just the latest manifestation of Saudi-Iranian rivalry. If that's the case, what are the recommendations to end that proxy war in these countries?
The rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would say that the causes of these civil wars, which have had such a destabilizing effect on the region and the world, are largely internal. They relate back to a crisis of political legitimacy in the region. Leaders who are, in some many cases, corrupt, who've not been able to deliver proper services, effective governance to their citizens, and this has created the state collapse in some instances that has produced these civil wars. But what they have become, as you've pointed out, is a battleground for different sectarian interests, which has been dangerous and destabilizing and further undermined trust and the relationship between countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran. So for that and many, many other reasons, ending these civil wars, beginning to wind them down, finding negotiated settlements to the conflicts, and beginning to put these states back together as legitimate, effective states has got to be a top priority.
But Libya is another country where regional backing of competing factions is impeding a political solution. Is there a role for the U.S. to stabilize Libya?
I think so. And I think it's, as your question, I think, implies, there are various kinds of U.S. intervention that are possible, and I'm not advocating for the kind of military intervention that we've seen the U.S. engage in other parts of the region. What we do think the U.S. can do is exercise leadership. Leadership in terms of how we begin to bring that conflict towards an end. And when we were looking at Libya in the report, we talked about the importance of a united international community working to support government of national accord in Tripoli and trying to sideline or marginalize forces that would undermine their authority, and hope that over time, in that way, you can reconstitute an effective Libyan state.
Is that where the U.S. stands so far?
Libya is very far down on the radar screen right now.
All right. Well, Iraq is not. So while we're on the subject of specific civil conflicts, Iraq is a major issue with great stakes for the region and, of course, the United States, as the United States tries to help the government in defeating the last remnants of so-called Islamic State. But internally, you say in the report, and we know this from press reports, that there's so much more that the Iraqi government could be doing. The Shia militias, which are backed to the hilt by Iran, are an irritant to the Sunni community who has been marginalized. What is your major recommendation to bring that conflict to an end and to bring stability to that important country?
I think a key part of this is the political dimension. And we always think about these conflicts in military terms, but we need at the same time to think of them in political terms. At the end of the day, Iraq will be stable when the citizens of Iraq feel like they have an equal and equitable stake in a government that serves the interests of all Iraqis. We've seen some positive steps by the Iraqi government in that direction, but not nearly enough. And even as we move to dislodge ISIS from Mosul, we need to be thinking about what the future political makeup of Iraq looks like in encouraging our Iraqi partner to create an Iraq where Sunnis feel welcome and have a stake in their governance.
Steve, the report praised the role of civil society in Tunisia in averting a civil war and in a peaceful transition to democracy. The opposite had taken place in Egypt, where the civil society is severely constrained. What should the U.S. do to encourage the Egyptian regime to open up the political space?
That's a very good question. What we really highlight most of all in the report is the tremendous dynamism that you see at the grassroots level in many countries in the region. It's a very young region where about two-thirds of the population, most states, are under 30. They tend to be better educated than their parents, more connected to the rest of the world, more connected to each other, and they tend to be more empowered and entrepreneurial. And everywhere we went and everything we heard about suggests a younger generation that's not willing to wait for change, that is keen to create a region that furthers their own values and interests, and to create that through their own sweat and toil. That's promising. Those are what we call possible green shoots of change, and they need to be nurtured. But they can only be nurtured if the security environment is conducive to that, and if the political environment is conducive to that. So that's why we place such an emphasis on the civil wars and winding them down. But it's also why we place such an emphasis on governments doing the right thing, responding to this younger generation that has both heightened expectations of their governments, but also heightened capabilities to help those governments address the many social problems and economic problems that they face. And these governments should not be afraid of their societies, but should see them as partners in building a new society and new countries.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Stephen Grand, Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with senior VOA Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook at the same address. Now here's a shout out to loyal listener Inusa Mohammed from Gombe, Nigeria. Thank you for your kind feedback, Inusa. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email like Inusa to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Stephen Grand from the Atlantic Council. Well, Stephen, we were talking about winding down civil wars. You talked about how the regimes, you know, have to start to pay attention to their people, the growing, you know, youth. But we saw the so-called Arab Spring and the deterioration of things. We had rebellions, then we have now autocratic regimes, you know, pushing back, perhaps the only bright spot being Tunisia. So that leads me to Syria, another important civil war that needs to be wound down. It didn't have to be a civil war. We had youth protesters simply coming out on the streets, wanting to breathe, wanting to have more freedom, like their Tunisian brethren. But now we have a full-blown civil war. We have other actors, Iran, Hezbollah, Russia. Some fault President Barack Obama for not doing enough, for not enforcing the so-called red line back in 2013. But here we are today. Some argue that Mr. Trump is doing better, at least in actually punishing the regime for the use of chemical weapons, which were supposed to have been removed, but that's another story. So what is your recommendation regarding Syria, given all these challenges?
Well, in Syria, too, the challenge is putting a failed state back together again. And what I think the Trump administration has been good at doing is to give U.S. military a little bit more leeway in helping various forces that are aligned with us in Syria to have their efforts on the ground have greater effect. What this lacks, though, is some sort of diplomatic or political strategy as to how you translate military gains on the ground into a political settlement, a negotiated political settlement that unites Syrians of different ideological and religious bents and begins to put a state back together again.
So you think it can be put back together?
It's a very, very difficult task. But as Secretary Kerry said when he was in the office, he lacked, most of all at the bargaining table, leverage. The way you get leverage is by a greater military presence on the ground. That doesn't mean U.S. troops in the front line, but it means U.S. troops helping to enable our friends in the region to be effective ground fighting forces.
Okay, but quickly, Mr. Trump has said, and even Mr. Obama said this, that, you know, our biggest threat there, biggest challenge is so-called ISIS. But the regime of Bashar al-Assad is a murderous regime backed by Iran and Hezbollah. So they're almost two sides of the same coin. So you can maybe get rid of ISIS in Raqqa, but then what? We're handing over back to Bashar al-Assad, who has barrel-bombed his own people, fought them with chemical weapons. I mean, this is, many would say, a war criminal. And we have even our ambassador at the UN, Nikki Haley, who is very strong on this, but we don't know how much leverage she has within the administration. So then what?
Well, I think that's exactly, you've put your finger on the very problem we face. If we want to be effective, we have to get beyond thinking we're going to be able to defeat ISIS militarily without doing anything about the problem of the Syrian civil war. We have to address the political problem of what is the future of Syria. And the way you gain leverage is by controlling territory in the east. So not just routing ISIS from Raqqa, but also moving south and making clear that the United States and its proxies are a veritable force on the ground that needs to be listened to in any future negotiation. You're trying to get leverage. This is not a civil war that's going to be won by either side. It's going to be eventually decided around a negotiating table. And we need to show through our actions that we have the capability, through our presence on the ground, but also through our diplomatic prowess, of shaping the future of Syria and not leaving that task to the Iranians or the Russians.
Steve, experts are concerned that Egyptian President Sisi is emboldened by the Trump administration's focus on counterterrorism at the expense of pluralism and political reform. Is there any recommendations to correct such imbalance?
Well, I think it's very much in our interest, and it's in the interests of these states to allow pluralism, to recognize that they are not going to succeed over the long term in governing if they continue to try to put civil society back into a box. The youth of the region have experienced the Arab Spring. It was not successful, but they know now that they have a voice, and they're making that voice heard, and they're continuing to make that voice heard even after the Arab Spring. And governments, in some cases, are listening. You see the prospect of significant reform in Saudi Arabia. Where does that come from? I think it comes in part from the recognition that the price of oil is going to be lower for a significant period of time. But I think it also comes from the recognition that this is a younger generation that is demanding a place in governing and that the regime needs to make way for them.
Well, we certainly see that in Saudi Arabia, at least in the recent succession of their new crown prince, much younger, to take over eventually after King Salman.
And I think that's drawn support from many in Saudi Arabia because he echoes their desires and concerns of many people in society.
On the other hand, he's perceived by an older generation, even just, you know, in their 50s, which one could consider still relatively young, just people with experience, they're concerned that he is somewhat reckless vis-a-vis, for example, we haven't spoken yet about Yemen and Saudi's efforts to rout the Houthi rebels who are perceived to be backed by Iran. Once again, we have the Saudi-Iranian rivalry, proxy rivalry playing out in Yemen.
And, you know, this too is a civil war that is destabilizing, doesn't need to be happening, where we should be having a serious conversation with our Saudi interlocutors saying, look, this is not in your interest. You're not going to win this war. and we need to find a settlement that will allow Yemen to continue as an independent state, will marginalize the influence of groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and will give a variety of different segments of Yemeni society a voice in governing.
I have a question about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which is continuing to fuel extremist narrative in the region. Does the strategy report you produced offer any role for the U.S. as a peace broker?
It does. It makes clear that with all that's going on in the region, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has gone down the list of priorities, the relative priorities of many in the region. But it is still a tragic stalemate, and it's in the interests of both Palestinians and Israelis to find a solution to the problem. At the moment, it's not clear that either the Palestinian leadership or the Israeli leadership are prepared to make the sacrifices necessary for peace. But that doesn't mean there aren't things that we can't do to lay the seeds for eventual negotiations and an eventual end of the conflict. And that includes building up the Palestinian Authority to make it an effective proto-state so that it is ready at the time of statehood to be a real state. And there are also things we can do to take advantage of the convergence of interests that's emerged between many Sunni states and Israel with regard to Iran and with regard to extremist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. And as you say in the report, the only way that rapprochement can become stronger is if there's some sort of an agreement, a two-state solution, because these Sunni states, whether it's Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, well, Egypt has a peace agreement, but it's a cold one, but others, the only way they'll come around to Israel more overtly is if finally they see, some sort of a perspective for a Palestinian state.
That's absolutely right. Right now, there's a lot of cooperation under the table. Israel would like it to be above the table, but for that to happen and for the cold peace with states like Egypt to become warm, or with Jordan as well, there must be progress towards a peace agreement.
Let's go back to your recommendation that the West, Europe, the United States, everyone needs to help unleash, the energy of the youth, this demographic in the region, which is growing and growing, of young people. What do you think is the best way to unlock the potential of youth and women who could make major contributions to the region towards stability and liberty?
Sure. I think in instances where governments are willing to give them the space, greater space to operate and to independently act, we should meet more with more, that we should be prepared to support states that are looking to reform their educational system, that are trying to bring women more actively into the workforce and into the political system, to states that are looking to make civil society a real partner in addressing social issues. We and others should be prepared to support that, whether it's with technical support or financial support. We talk in the report about the possibility of a regional reform and development fund that would support these kinds of initiatives, bottom-up initiatives that we're seeing in the region, but where money would be allocated on a more-for-more principle, that where we saw states moving in the right direction, we would add.
Who's that? The United States?
We being the United States, we being Europe, we also being other concerned states in the region.
Okay.
There are Gulf countries that have expressed interest in this kind of vehicle.
Well, that's probably going to be what will happen. I mean, even right now, our proposed budget for the State Department cutting 30%, we hear that the Congress will not allow that. But even still, the message is we're going to cut back. That is the United States. So I guess I'm asking you, do you think Europe will step up in some of these Gulf states in whose interest it may not be to unleash freedom and democracy because it threatens their power?
Well, they do have an interest in seeing countries that they're supporting in the region, like Egypt, actually use the money that they're being given from other Arab states, using it effectively and undertaking reforms that will actually secure their legitimacy over time. We have to understand, too, that if we want to address the problems of the Middle East, the best tools we have are largely diplomatic and economic. And so cutting the State Department budget, cutting the U.S. aid budget only hinders those efforts.
One principle of the recommended strategy is that stability cannot improve as long as regional states continue to intervene in each other's internal affairs. If Iran is an obvious example, what about the Gulf crisis pitting Qatar against Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt?
Right. One of the things we point out in the report is that almost every other region of the world has effective regional institutions that exist for purposes of collective security, but also for purposes of regional economic, political, and social cooperation. And that really is lacking in the Middle East. And we are seeing how that plays out in varying ways. In what other region do you see four civil wars all occurring at the same time?
With no intervention from the Arab League, for example.
Right, with no action.
Yeah.
So there is a need for a regional body to emerge that can address these kinds of challenges. To the question of the current standoff with Qatar, the disunity right now within the GCC, which is the one model of positive regional cooperation, though small, that disunity is harmful. It's harmful to the Gulf states. It's harmful to the things that we want to do in the region. I think there are legitimate disputes between many of the Gulf states and Qatar, and as well as with Egypt. Egypt has issues with Qatar as well. But the kinds of demands that have been made of Qatar and in the way in which those demands were made, I don't think are going to produce the kind of result that's desired. I don't think the Qataris are just going to accede to the many demands that have been placed upon them by the Saudis, the Bahrainis, the Emiratis, and the Egyptians.
But the U.S. is having a role in mediating this crisis between the disputed parties?
Well, I think Secretary Tillerson has seen this as a real threat and challenge. We have a very large military base near Doha in Qatar, and we have an interest in seeing this dispute resolved.
We certainly have an interest, but we're also seeing a bit of disunity or contradiction within our own government. We have Mr. Tillerson at the State Department at odds, in a sense, with the White House on this issue, at least rhetorically, so that's not good. What we're seeing, it seems to me, Stephen Grant, as we close, a theme of disunity, perhaps within the West or among the West, as well as within the Arab world and the Muslim world, which doesn't augur well, and yet you are still relatively optimistic about this region.
Well, I see grounds for optimism, but to capture that optimism, to seize upon that optimism, one needs a strategy and one needs American leadership. And I think that is a challenge going forward. The great moments of American diplomacy of the last 70 years have come when America has been able to envision a better future for a particular region and then, together with others, taking diplomatic action to realize that vision. We need a vision and a strategy now in the region.
And if we don't, how do you see the consequences playing out?
I think the consequences will be catastrophic. We've seen the political effect that instability in the Middle East has created for the politics of Europe and also for the politics of the United States. And those pressures, that destabilization, is only going to spread over time.
Stephen Grant is Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council. Stephen, congratulations on your report, and thank you for your wonderful insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Cornelius Tenner. And joining me on the program was Mohammed El-Shenawi, Senior VOA Middle East Reporter. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.